All right, new podcast. We're late, Rutchett.
I know, both of our faults. But yeah. I did remind you, so what the hell, Valentine?
This is like not. We tried to do it. So, in all fairness, we tried to do it on Monday. Was it Monday?
Monday at the gym.
Oh yeah, at my condo building's gym.
And that driven Asian lady who wanted to work out at 1 a.m.
Yeah.
Just decided to ruin it for us.
So now we had to wait until Thursday to do it, but better late than never. So I'm going to start off with a joke. You ready for this?
Yeah, man. Right, I love jokes.
Okay, so this is a true story
okay.
that I'm going to read. So I was walking across a bridge one day. Don't read it.
I'm not reading it.
Okay, okay.
I'm reading your eyes.
I was walking across a bridge one day, and I saw a man standing on the edge about to jump off.
Oh, no.
I immediately ran over, and I said, "Stop, don't do it." "Why shouldn't I?" he said. I said, "Well, there's so much to live for." "Like what?" "Well, are you religious or atheist?" "Religious." "Oh, cool, me too. Are you Christian or Jewish?" "Christian." "Oh, cool, me too. Are you Catholic or Protestant?" "Protestant." "Oh, cool. Me too. Are you Episcopalian or Baptist?" "Baptist." "Wow, that's what a coincidence. Me too. Are you Baptist Church of God or Baptist Church of the Lord?" "Baptist Church of the Lord." "Ah, awesome, me too. Are you original Baptist Church of God or are you Reformed Baptist Church of God?" "Reformed Baptist Church of God." "Okay, great, me too. Are you Reformed Baptist Church of God Reformation of 1879 or Reformed Baptist Church of God Reformation of 1915? "Oh, of course, I'm Reformed Baptist Church of God Reformation of 1915. To which I said, "Die, heretic scum," and pushed him off.
This is good. I had a slight hint and maybe going down that direction, but it was still worth it at the end.
When I read this, I read this joke like a week ago, and I think I was really tired, and I was like, just kind of scanning text, and at the end I was like, ah!
It's using a lot of words, so it's on point for that sense.
Yeah.
I think I've heard a joke like this in a similar vein with like a different tangent that he went on. But I don't know what it was, but I think that's the only reason why I knew like what was slightly coming. But it still gives you a good chuckle.
Yeah, good chuck.
A good chuck. Oh,
Ratchet's nickname to girls he's just met is Chuck.
Yeah, why are you ruining it for all the audience?
For all the girls who are
yeah. That's why I hand him my.
Well, they've been emailing us saying like, "Where's the podcast for us?"
Because I hand like a business card that says NFC and Chuck on the back of it.
Yeah,
no other contact information.
Make orange juice.
Yeah, you got to figure out the rest.
Yeah. Okay, so what are we discussing in this podcast? What is it?
Econo-linguistics, eco-no-linguistics.
Eco-linguistics?
Science publicists?
We really took a... Well, I guess it's not. I think it... I mean, the flow makes sense.
Yeah, like the arc in which we started to where we ended, there is like some connection, but it wasn't necessarily the direction that I thought we were going to go when I first thought of it, which is good. Is what you want from... random topics that you're making up from thin air.
So what did you, this econo-linguistics idea, you got it from a professor who told you about it?
No, it was me and him discussing it. Just randomly, I was just like, how can you quantify words? Has anybody tried to do that? It feels like...
The value of words.
The value of words, and morphemes specifically. And if you were to do that and embark on that...
Explain what a morpheme is.
So a morpheme is the smallest meaningful unit of a word. So, for example...
butcher this now.
Yeah, I know.
A bunch of linguists.
I'm glad that you gave me this time to think while we're discussing this topic.
Put you on the spot.
Yeah, you put me on the spot. And now
I just want to know, like, intuitively, what is, like, some... You don't have to give it too rigorously, but...
Like, nation. The shen... will make it a noun.
Is that a phoneme or
morpheme? So
what's the difference? So phoneme is like has to do with sound.
Yeah, so that's the smallest meaningful sound unit,
okay.
Right? So like f versus th.
Right, and certain languages have different phonemes that they can make out and other ones.
Exactly. So like that was where the discussion started, and then I was like, okay, if you are to do it, maybe the URL market would be interesting because there's just such a large supply of it, and you could quantify that directly by seeing and comparing words in different URLs and how much they're worth in the open URL market, not the one that's already been taken, and then also compare that to the open trademark market. But I guess, like, yeah, it's interesting just as a topic, but I don't know where else you would kind of branch off unless you actually just do the study and then talk about it. Other than, I think you mentioned like another way to do it, another way to quantify, did you not, or no?
Good question. I think I...
No.
I just suggested...
Yeah, you suggested like different varieties to explore in terms of how
we value certain
words, yeah. Foreign sounding names or famous name changes and catchy names, how they would be possible results of this kind of analysis.
So I think just maybe we can talk quickly about that initial idea. Do you think there is inherent value in words, or is it completely based on context, like the context of your... So, I mean, the value can still be derived from context, but I just mean, like, is it something that's really, really specific to a country, a location, a time, or is it something else? Is it more absolute?
I think, well, with every single thing, we derive value based on context. Like, money is a contextual
But
within that scope, a burger, there's a burger index, right? How much a hamburger is worth, McDonald's hamburger is worth in different countries.
But if I gave you, so maybe the better question is, if I gave you a comparison and I said, like, if you had to name your company A or B, do you think most people would say A? Like, are there two words where people will agree this one is definitely the better brand name? Or is it completely, you can never reach consensus there and it depends on where you go?
So that's what I was trying to get at with my first point, that it's neither at either extreme. It's there's always like some sort of gray context that shines its light to every kind of things that and any kind of thing that you place value on. So with respect to words and their values, yeah, it's going to be contextually dependent because language inherently is, right? And language in Toronto is different than language in even New York, like if you're still talking about English. So, and like the different values of toque in Toronto, where you use hats more often and it's called toque, and toque in New York would be way different. But I still think there is like a phonetic aspect of things that people like the way certain sounds go together, which are...
So for instance, to that point, in French, they'll add... like filler letters sometimes if things sound bad. So like a-t-il, like if you flip like he has, il a, into a question instead of saying a-il, which to them those two vowel sounds sound ugly.
Yeah.
They'll add a T in there just to make it flow a bit better. So certain languages do that explicitly.
Exactly. And I think there's a few specific cases where even in English, we have tendencies that we want to make things sound nicer.
Yeah.
So like consonant cluster simplification. When there's a bunch of consonants together, we like eliminate the middle consonant. Like it depends.
And
you don't say the D in the NDS, right?
Right. But that's also dialect and specific, right, dialect dependent. So if you are, an example of these is, for instance, I forget what it's called, but when you change T's into CH sounds, ch, so tree, that's a very North American sort of broadcast English accent, whereas in a British accent, they don't do that. Or in a British accent, they don't pronounce the R in car.
Yeah.
Right? And so...
Or even in Boston.
Yeah, in Boston. Car. But
get
then they have the vowel shift.
Out of your khaki pants.
Right. So, I mean, I think one of the interesting things that could, like, we're sort of talking about all these truisms. It's definitely, like, you know, depending on where you go, you're going to have certain things that are local. But what about maybe this foreign-sounding sort of concept is interesting? Because, I mean, to me, this was when I first read about this, this is new. Like, the fact that Haagen-Dazs started in Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah.
And they named it that because
they... I was surprised
to
hear that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they came up with that name because it sounded like some sort of mix of, you know, Scandinavian and, like, Swedish and, like, places that would make... like this ice cream that seemed, you know, exotic yeah. And
like it totally crafted. Works. Yeah. Like, even though I know that,
yeah,
it just sounds more, oh, that they know how to do chocolate and ice cream way better than.
So is it better than like Chapman's?
I think that has its own kind of American feel, you know, but, I do agree that there is some, like, there is some value in, foreign marketing too, right? When you think of beer, you have imported beer and domestic beer. So, like, the idea of something coming from afar, inherently, we as human beings place value just because it takes so much time and effort to get it from there. And
yeah, it must have been worth the effort to...
And you create your own imagination, like, you use your imagination to create your own idea of how they produce it there, or... You know, you have some idea of German engineering, so does that apply to
right.
German beer or whatever it is, right? So there is that.
So is that absolute? Do all people, maybe not all, but do most people value things that sound foreign? Or is that also just cultural dependent? Does the East also value?
I think it depends on the, like, the type of... product you're talking about.
Right. Of course, there's exceptions. Like, certain things may just have negative connotations for whatever
reason. And some things just have bad branding. Like, some countries have worse branding.
So, if you can control for all those things and have something that's completely sounding like foreign. So, in China, you go to and then present them two brands.
Yeah.
One that's English, they have nothing, they have no idea about it. And one that's Chinese. Are they going to value that English brand a bit more? And I'll answer. I think they would. Which is interesting because I know I read this on Reddit recently about how there are positions in Chinese companies for white people who generally are like taller and sort of like more, they look like businessy white people in suits. They just follow around these Chinese CEOs.
Yeah.
And they're just paid to act like essentially, you know, people who make them look busy and important. Because other Chinese people will look at it and say, oh, he's talking to some white person. That means he's, you know, he's doing something important. He's dealing with some whatever foreign thing.
I'm sure there's no positions for short Indian men.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Canadian accent.
Yeah.
Part-time.
I don't know, perhaps. But there's a whole thread about how, you know, some guy was telling people about he did this and
yeah.
he made good money. Just following some dude around and, like, looking like he was important.
Yeah, so to your point about an English-sounding name, well, that just goes to the branding of white America and English, or like the white Western world in China, at least the business world, and how that places itself in the Chinese business world. And because of that branding, that would work. So it's still, like, I think that's why it would be kind of interesting to find the results of something like this study or this analysis to see where those cultural biases work and where they don't, right? And if you can, like, group together certain words and make a strata where that, like, shows that in the Chinese business world, it has a positive view of the English or the Western white business world because of all these types of words that are used in a positive sense or valued more in a positive sense in the Chinese URL market. It may not make complete sense because Chinese URL markets are probably going to use Chinese URLs. But
no, actually, they don't, right? So there's another interesting thing that on that, just FYI.
Okay.
It's kind of related, but in China, a lot of URLs use... numbers.
Yeah.
Because URLs for now are not Unicode, so you can't use Chinese characters.
Okay.
And two, certain numbers sound like certain characters. So the word, like, the number in English, I think.
Yeah.
I may be slightly mistaken. But so the number 9, they don't even use Arabic numerals, obviously, but the number 9 sounds like a certain character. And so sometimes you'll have, like, Chinese URLs that look like 98764.
Yeah, yeah. I think even in Arabic, I've seen, like, some of my friends I think some of my friends who post, like, comments on pictures and they're speaking, or Lebanese or Arabic, where they post or they write ASD for whatever they're trying to say, and they mix together letters and numbers, alphanumeric comments.
Because it sounds like something in Lebanese?
Exactly, exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So one thing I thought it'd be interesting to talk about right now is this idea of languages with present, what's it called, weak or strong future tenses.
Okay.
So this is something that is also interesting because I noticed this in certain accents, and now you understand why this happens. So a lot of, German people will say, I meet you here, or I meet you at 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
Which sounds kind of awkward in English because usually we'll say, I will. So in German, it's a weak future tense, which means you can say in present to imply something you're doing in the future. In English, it's a fairly strong future tense, so I will meet you at 2 p.m.
Yeah.
And there's a study that showed that there's a correlation between this and how much you save.
That's really interesting because, like, I know English is a Germanic language.
Mm-hmm.
So where did we get, and you don't usually borrow these kinds of, what's the category of present, future,
tenses,
verbs,
tense
verbs? You don't usually borrow tense verbs, for lack of a better term, from other languages. So, we had a lot of borrowings from French. We had a lot of borrowings for technical language in Greek. But, like, most of our language core, like the word for mom, the word for son, comes from Germany or Germanic roots, right?
So
that's weird.
It might come from French. Like, so English has borrows a lot of things from French as well. This study says that the weak future tenses are, for example, German, Finnish, Estonian. So it seems like maybe
irregular verbs. I think that's what it's called. Sorry. Okay. Anyways.
Right. Going back to this study is that if you speak as if the future is far away, it's sort of you're separating this yourself from your future self.
Yeah.
And not only did they save, the people with weak future tends to save more. They were, get this, 30% more likely to save money, 24% more likely to avoid smoking, 29% more likely to exercise regularly, and 13% less likely to be obese. So some of these, obviously, there's probably difficult variables to control for, cultural variables. But still, there's overwhelmingly...
Yeah. Enough to, like, have a discussion.
And I think it makes sense. There's the other thing I mentioned in that post.
So let's just clarify the idea. So the idea here is... You don't differentiate your present sense or present sense
less.
Itself.
It's not that you don't, but you do it less.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So you, on average, you will differentiate yourself now less from your future self.
Exactly.
So that becomes a holistic person. So you care about decisions that will affect your future self because it's the same guy.
Exactly.
Right?
And
which I thought was... So when I first read this, and I think I mentioned I was going to talk about this later, but I didn't get to it, but I thought it was counterintuitive. For me at least it was, sorry.
Why?
I don't know. I just thought, if you think of yourself in the future tense more, then you are considering that guy a lot more.
Exactly. So you save more and you exercise more because you consider that person more.
No, but when you're using more future tense verbs. So like, I will do this.
Oh, you're saying, no, yeah, right.
That's what I thought. That's what the study will show because you're using will and all these. Because you're creating this other guy. So I'm like, I got to... be concerned about him because he's going to exist.
No, but he's a different guy. That's the point.
Because, I get the logic, but I like the fact that You can have intuitive logic on both sides.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's the way at least I interpreted it.
Okay.
But
okay.
I understand the other way of
right.
seeing that intuition.
Right. And then and this also a similar result by this Kelly McGonigal professor lady who has a great talk on YouTube and has a book called The Willpower Instinct, which talks about ways to improve your willpower. And one of the biggest ways for her was to just I think one of the things was write a letter to your future self. Or there's like this really famous study where people who looked at a digitally made picture of themselves when they were older.
Yeah.
And then were asked how much are you going to save or whatever, put away into some savings account right after. Just, I mean, I'm assuming their controlled variables were good. Just by looking at that picture of themselves when they were older, they would on average save or put away more money.
Yeah.
Because they felt like they, you know, they knew that person. And at least for me, that rings true. That, like, it's very 100%. Sort of, yeah. Because often, you know, it's when you procrastinate, when you do all these things, you're sort of, you take that short-term gain and sort of push away that long-term. You think, oh, I'll deal with this later.
Yeah.
Because you don't even think about, well, that's going to suck to deal with this later.
Well, like, and it's still, like, in our evolution, it was such a later development, the concept of
like saving
or not even saving, like future self.
Well,
right, like I would still think that.
Don't you think that the cultures that saved up
no but
like, reserve of whatever, like berries and stuff, and not just like you know, ravaged themselves and sat and chilled, but instead planned out their next whatever?
Yeah, but that came after just scavenging for your food immediately. Right?
Maybe.
Agriculture came much after that.
Right.
Right? That's
I'm
where
not
civilization
even saying about agriculture,
came.
Though. It's not necessarily just, you know, using a farm or whatever. It's just, it's more thinking about, you know.
Yeah.
Okay,
that,
great.
That came afterwards.
Well,
I think that first we just thought about our first meal, like what's our meal to come. And then later in evolutionary development,
sure,
like we came to that.
I'm just saying that it's that. Is not necessarily just agriculture. It happened before.
Yeah,
I agree
sure.
that ultimately, at some point, we were still, you know, just looking out for, you know, the next thing to satisfy our primordial
needs. And like, to the point of having a picture, it makes it a lot more real, right? When you see yourself there, that abstract concept becomes a lot more, hey, that's me. You know, and you can see, read, or whatever, and like make that idea of 2 years into the future, or even 2 weeks in the future, a lot more tangible.
So, can we link this back to sort of the value of words? And if we're speaking a language that has a weak future tense, like German,
yeah,
right, that means that you're more. Words that the way you phrase certain taglines, right? You can try to induce more, say, spending or more saving in a sense, but saving for your future self because those people are more attuned with, you know, what to do for the future. You can market certain things and they'll respond to certain things more.
So banks, for example, banks want your money in your account.
Yeah.
Right. They give you lots of incentives to do so. So if you're working on the marketing side of a bank
in Germany, you wanna focus on look at these nice old people and their great house because they saved, and you should do that too. But in Canada or in the States, maybe you shouldn't focus on that, but you should focus on, hey, we'll give you a free iPad Mini if you come. Which
yeah,
are,
well, like, well, if
which
if
RBC you, does,
but if you're looking at the consequences of the language already, so that's like deciding those marketing tactics based on the consequence of what the language is produced in the people.
Right.
But if you just use that idea and just use it across the board, the language itself you're using should be more present tense. So. When you're talking about marketing for a savings account, you shouldn't be talking about, you know, you, like when they put yourself in that commercial, you will have a lot of money in the future.
Because who cares about that person?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right? So you should be using, like, how would the savings affect them right now?
Or like, or maybe closer than you would do in other countries.
Yeah, right? So like...
A year down the road.
Exactly. If they're using this, you know, fake care, fake couple, Jenny and Jim. Jenny and Jim has saved enough for their vacation in December.
Exactly, yeah.
Right?
And you know what? That's... When we talk about this, this is totally true. Like, if you look at the commercials for savings accounts, rarely do you see, like, a happy old couple saying, we're glad we saved for retirement when we were 20, like, started saving when we were in our 20s or whatever. It's more like, you know, you can save for your perfect house. Like, it's much more immediate rewards. Or you can save for your vacation, just like you said.
Yeah.
Whereas I would be interested to see what... Is it true that in places like Germany and other places where that have weak future tenses, do they market more for that person who's far down in the future?
That would be very interesting.
I should look this up.
Yeah, that would be... Like, I don't know if people have done studies on that itself. Like, maybe that... What's the author's name?
So this study...
Maybe we should email her and tell her.
Keith Chen at Yale.
Let's email Keith Chen. Ask him.
Yeah, we should do it.
Yeah.
Keith Chen, if you're listening.
On the odd chance that you've Googled you want never from concentrate.com and you randomly type blog instead of juice.
All right, so let's move on. We got, I still want to talk about this science sort of.
Publicist?
Publicizing science that we got to. So.
Oh, I remember what I wanted to talk about.
What?
Remember I said I wanted to talk about something?
Okay.
It was with science publishing.
Okay, great.
But
I
also
have a point. Okay, so we moved from, you know, how do words have value, or do they have value, and how can we quantify that, to essentially how can we publicize certain scientific findings or spread them in an efficient manner, in a way that... you know, maybe is, what am I trying to say? That uses, or that inspires as little controversy as possible and essentially goes away from really catchy headlines and more towards, you know, substantial facts.
And sort of or a like summary. A balance of both, right? You want some
well,
catchiness.
If there's a catchy headline, there should be a catchy headline, but you shouldn't have to extract it just to, you know, publish.
Yeah.
Some nuanced result that might not be catchy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. So, like, the way we got here, too, was discussing eco-linguistics when you cleverly wrote eco-no-linguistics, which made me smile. Not a chuckle, but a smile. It's still worth something in the LOL culture we live in.
Yeah, yeah, smuckle.
Yeah. I'd write LOL in a message, but I wouldn't be laughing. I would be smiling. It's one of those LOLs, you know?
Right.
I stopped using LOL, just for the record.
Yeah.
And
I just write winky faces everywhere.
Yeah? Yeah.
Yeah.
You're a winky face.
Ha-ha, winky face. Because you never know, right? Like,
are you a ha-ha or a ha-ha-ha?
With a one H?
No, like how many ha's do you use?
Oh, wait. So there's a whole, like, have you not seen that picture of a scale? Like... So two ha-has is like whatever.
Yeah, yeah. It's
ha is like you're being sarcastic.
Two ha-has is honestly diplomatic. That's what it is.
Right, right. I don't want to piss you off.
But like, you know, I get what you mean.
Anyways.
It's like you're like looking half-eyed like, yeah,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I got
cool,
you, bro.
Yeah, I got you. And then there's like a whole bunch of things in the middle, and the last one was like four ha's, and that's just like, I want to fuck you.
It's true, man.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's true.
So I'm gonna look through my messages and see how many ha's you've sent me.
Yeah.
Have you ever sent me a four ha's?
Oh, you're gonna get some four ha's.
Yes.
If I haven't already. But with eco-linguistics, the biggest thing that we talked about, which is directly related to science PR, is global warming, because that's probably like the most front-centered
mess-up
in... The last, I guess, in the PR culture that we've been in the last.
I don't know if I call it a mess up. I'm not sure why you're saying it's a mess up. Why is it a mess up?
Because I think when I initially had no idea what global warming was, and I first heard it.
Yeah.
I thought it's great, you know? Global warming. We're in Canada. It's right. Cold. The whole world's going to get warmer.
But that's because...
That means I'm going to be, like...
Okay.
Out of longer summers.
But we're not marketing to, like, 8-year-olds who can't think through ideas. Like, we're marketing to...
But still, I think that, like, the first impression is so important when you hear something for the first time. And if you're talking, if you're really analyzing words and how important they are in terms of what they symbolize for the concept, especially in science, then yeah, you have to take that into consideration.
Okay. No, that's a good point. I still wouldn't call it a mess up, though. I would say it was...
I'd call it a mess up.
Parts of it, the thing is, though, like, it also goes back to our point, it goes to this point that we brought up that there is no central marketing authority for science. You know, how could there be, really? But, and so this concept of global warming, it'd be interesting to see the etymology here, but it probably came from the early findings that, in general, the temperature has gone up. And that's true, but that doesn't mean that, you know, for instance, it doesn't mean it's a good thing, obviously, and it could mean warm generally has a good connotation.
Yeah.
So it probably by some accident in some famous article, we came to describe this climate change as global warming.
So I actually just Googled global warming etymology. And in the Wikipedia article, I'm just going to read this out loud, according to Eric M. Conway, which I'm curious to see who the hell this guy is, he's a historian at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
I think I referenced him, but go on.
Did you actually? Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
But global warming became the dominant popular term after June 1988 when NASA climate scientist James Hansen used the term in a testimony to Congress. When he said, global warming has reached a level such that we can ascribe with a high degree of confidence a cause and effect relationship between the greenhouse gas effect and the observed warming. So that's where it came from, 1988. That's crazy. I had no idea.
Right. So they pinned it down to one testimony. This one dude.
Yeah.
Came up with it. Or not? Maybe people used it before, but after that it seemed to be...
That was like the birth of the right. Widespread...
So this may have some connotations that maybe aren't good for the thing you're trying to spread. But like I brought up, is any publicity good publicity? So now people, when you say global warming, people have this it's very divisive.
But that's a post-humorous analysis of it. You want to get yourself into. If there was a marketing, science marketing firm or a science PR firm that exists in 1988 and they're like, hey, James Hansen, dude, we got to talk. You know, you have this testimony coming up. It's a pretty big deal. Or even if it isn't, we want to like look over what you're saying and how you're using this term. If this is as serious as the science community right now, the public don't know about it. Okay, we got to think about what we want to call this term if it does become as serious as it is. That's where you have that discussion. You can't say that just because...
But he didn't... The thing is, that's great to, again, looking back, hindsight's 2020. You're saying, oh...
But that should be like, even if you don't know how big it's going to become, even if it was a, you know, a false positive and it wasn't really a big deal and people got it all wrong, there should have been some intervention and then discussion at that point. You can't say that... Oh, because any publicity is good publicity just because it became big and that's how you're going to like think about global warming as a good term or a bad term. It has to be like back then, what would be the right call to make?
Okay, so who would decide those kind of things? Like who, like we talked about a bit about, you know, publicists.
I elect myself.
But
I am the authority after having two linguistics courses.
But I think the point that, you know, every single actor, or I mean the majority of actors, have a dedicated person who is just responsible for publicizing their shit. They're publicist.
Yeah.
They're just like, what do I do? What do I wear? How do I act?
Yeah. What shows do I go on? Yeah. What do I say?
And I bet some of the high profile scientists also have a publicist, but
yeah,
it's like not the same thing.
Richard Dawkins, Leonard Krauss.
Yeah.
Right?
These guys, Neil deGrasse Tyson probably has a publicist.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, their publicist probably advises them on their image, so to speak. They're not advising them on how they're not like a scientific advisor in the sense that they don't advise them, you know, here's a result I got. How do I best tell this to the public?
Yeah, because you have to have some technical knowledge. Exactly. There. There's no, I don't know. I actually was trying to Google this before I came.
Is there a technical publicist?
I was looking like science publicist. Does that like just, you know, looking for jobs if that exists?
So universities have things like their official PR departments are definitely not just marketing people. They have technical writers who have a technical background, and their whole job is to just, you know, look at papers that the university has published, write it up into some sort of, you know, easy to digest way, and release it as a PR.
So what we are proposing is that those people, when or whoever's hiring these people, should be looking for all that technical shenanigans and whatever that they're heading up the specific department's PR, plus maybe like an internship at a copywriting firm, a creative advertising copywriting firm, or a minor in creative writing, right? Something more.
Or maybe you could have it doesn't have to be every person has both of those things. You could have one person who
sees it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like one guy is just devoted to analyzing that technical speak from a, you know, a non-technical creative, like, how will this affect the public domain market?
But, you know, it seems almost like that's sort of plugging a leaky basket, whatever you call it. You know,
what does that mean?
What I mean is that you're trying to contain this. So the analogy here is that the university has all these, like, really dangerous ideas, and what you're trying to do is funnel them through this one marketing department. But what I think probably would happen in that case is that you're still going to get these small little leaks all around the university because it's just impossible, right? There's no way everything you spread anywhere, especially with the internet, is going to go through the marketing department. Someone's just going to read your study, and someone's just going to publish an article, and they're going to say, you know, screw this stupid PR bullshit.
Well, fine. Like, if you can't do it in having a specific person there, then the university should at least administer some sort of lecture or, like, by somebody who has some authority in this that, hey, like, professors, you're publishing these papers, like, think about this for more than, like, half a second when you're writing this.
But the thing is, you're confounding two things. Well, they shouldn't have to think about that stuff when they're publishing papers. That's ridiculous. They publish their papers based on the results. They don't care about how, like, what their, you know, nuances of some word means. They want it to be as precise as possible, and that's it. If it's bad, it's bad. If it's good, it's good. Then there has to be some other form where, you know, if the Star goes and publishes some sort of thing that's clearly wrong, shouldn't the university go out and say, hey, listen, this is bullshit. That's not true. That's not what this study says.
Like the interpreter between like what the actual technical speak is and what they're publishing on like a newspaper or whatever.
Well, yeah. Like if I go and write an article in the Star saying like Ruchit Chakravarti is, I don't know, 5'2" to fix something that... push some buttons.
Don't even say that.
Right? You're gonna be like, take that down, change it to something that's true, or I'm gonna sue for defamation. That shit's gonna like lose me dates, right? So why can't universities go out and or you know, whatever, whoever this is, does this.
Police?
Yeah, they're not police so as much as just...
I like that. I think that could be a good band
police?
Name, too.
Science police.
Yeah, because science is mainstream now. It's become cool.
Why? When was it not mainstream?
I think in, like, the 80s.
They're just, like, they're jocks. Everyone was one-strapping.
Like, people watch Cosmos now. Like, that's a normal
people
thing.
Watch... Cosmos was an 80s show. That's not the worst example.
I know, that's
picked.
Probably the worst thing I could think. But it's... I don't know. It feels a lot more... I guess I've watched a lot of television.
It's just you were not alive in the 80s, so you have no idea.
No, I was alive. What are you talking about? I spent decades and decades.
Yeah.
It's a terrible example. ruin my point completely. But anyways.
Right, regardless. Right. So
I
just it's definitely becoming, so I will give you this, because of the internet, because of the access to information, people, it is easier than ever to go up and read, do your own research.
Yeah.
Whereas in the 70s, 80s, and especially earlier, you would really have to defer to experts.
Yeah.
Whereas now, anyone can say, well, I read this paper, and actually this is true, or whatever. So maybe now we just have to deal with a sort of changing landscape of how we spread scientific information, and we need more control over it. Otherwise, the danger here is that, sure, it doesn't matter as long as people believe some random stuff, and who cares, right? We have scientists who actually know what's going on. But if this starts, these kind of false beliefs start influencing policy, you know,
But like that kind of infringes to some degree on freedom of speech.
No, that's
I'm just saying that's what people can bring up.
Freedom of speech is different, right? Like, there's certain types of freedom of speech, and like I said, you can't just go publish an article saying false things. That's not freedom of speech. That's you're publishing false things. So in the same realm, if these kind of things, like for instance, the vaccination crap, right, with the autism shit, if that starts affecting people, and the whole premise of this is not true,
mm-hmm.
should there not be some sort of regulatory agency or something that...
See, that's the problem, though. Like, that's what people would bring up. Freedom of speech is what people would bring up if there was a regulatory agency, right? Because if you... What if something's controversial?
Right.
And the regulators disagree with one side that's maybe popular in a cult scientific community, but not popularized by mainstream, corporate funded scientists, right? So there's still even within the science world that there exists that. So then what? Then how do you control for that?
Compromise. I agree that you have to have some sort of compromise. Maybe you have a law that says you can publish this, but then you have to explicitly say that the universities do not agree with, you know, or whatever. Like, if a university tells you we do not agree with this particular viewpoint, you can still publish it, but then you have to say this university does not agree with this viewpoint or something like that, where because it's so easy to just spread something that seems, oh yeah, that totally valid, great, now I've changed my whole paradigm and this is what I believe, without getting that, you know.
But like, I, you know, to your preface thing, that we started this whole discussion in the internet culture, right? You can't control how people are going to publish stuff.
Maybe that's going to be even worse, right? If universities start doing that, then people are like, oh, this, it's kind of like, you know, don't think of an elephant type of thing.
Yeah, and like anybody can just, in 5 seconds, open up a Tumblr or a Blogger or some sort of WordPress account and start writing stuff and publishing stuff. And they don't have to be under any kind of control for that.
Well, maybe then we have to go, you know, I told you what's happening in Russia now, right, with the blogs.
What?
Any blog that has over 5,000 monthly visits
has
to be registered with the government so they can screen you to make sure you're not writing, like, things that are...
Just take a note from good old Putin.
Yeah.
When in doubt.
The Putin Science Police.
Yeah, just look...
That's the band name.
The Putin Science Police. There you go. It's a hard problem. I don't know what the exact solution is, but I do agree that there at least has to have some PR for future terms or some police for some things that are going at raw. Maybe even just like a non-for-profit that's just devoted to that. That
like the Better Business Bureau, but the Better Science Bureau.
Yeah, so like, whatever, like if people are confused about something, they can go there and be like, what do these guys think about this? Like,
but are you not just adding to the noise then? Because there probably already exists 10 different...
But that's where you're getting the signal from these guys, okay. Right? That's what would be the purpose. Would be like, hey, I can't, there's so much noise, I trust these guys because there's...
So, but that's the problem. How do you build trust with one organization? They're just another...
Well, like, it could, that's the whole point, that it would be non-profit, it would be a bunch of scientists, so it would be a bunch of different resources, and it doesn't have to be localized, it could be, you know,
global,
global global citizens of...
Actually, is that a startup idea where you...
It's not a startup idea because there's no business aspect of it.
You can have not-for-profit startups.
Okay, fine. It's a non-for-profit startup
idea. Yeah, there's tons of those.
Yeah. That'd be really cool. I'm all for science.
It's essentially interesting. Okay, we're almost at 45 minutes now, so we should start wrapping up. But what is that thing you want to talk about regarding science?
Oh, it's so out of place now because it completely went over the discussion. But it's just, I watched
the
show. You
can't tempt the...
I know, I'll tell you. Okay. I watch the show, infrequently, just like randomly when I have no show to watch.
Was it Miley Cyrus? Why are you prefacing?
No, it's not a bad show. It's a good show. Prefacing, by the way. Yeah. It's not a bad show. It just, the context.
Just what is the show, Dan?
You were the one who interrupted me like all the time. Masters of Sex. And even then. So,
wish we had sound effects.
Yeah. Like a soundboard.
Yeah.
Ooh. Damn. Oh no!
Is that like Arnold Schwarzenegger, like soundboard?
Yeah. That'd be great. It's great for prank calls and podcasts.
Yeah.
So Masters of Sex is about Virginia Johnson, and Johnson and William Masters. They were like the two founding researchers of sex, like the human sexual cycle.
Wasn't Kinsley one of them? Remember that movie with he did a whole bunch of studies about like homosexuality. Like he was one of the first people to suggest that homosexuality is like something that's not black and white, that everyone has some. Kinsley was a movie that came out 6 years ago.
Maybe, but like these guys were specifically about the human sexual cycle. So like what happens during sex and when you are arouse, your orgasm, all that. They're big, huge figures. But, like, there was one episode I just randomly decided to watch. It's a good show. I'm not, putting it down
just
anyway.
Just get to your point.
They were actually, looking to think about hiring a PR person for... for them. Because, they were discussing... I think some guy had published a paper and, stolen a couple of ideas. And... that was an idea that they suggested. And I think the show is loosely based on, I don't know how strongly based, but enough based on facts and what really happened. So they were considering it even at that point in the 60s or the 70s, whenever they existed, hiring a PR department or a PR firm to market their ideas or market their papers. And I think sex is a lot sexier, of course, comes from the word. But... It could, it existed there already.
There already is
some content.
I'm sure people think about things like that. It's just, who's going to pay for these things? And we need some sort of regulatory agency or something that, when you're a scientist and you're writing grants and stuff like that, that's the least of your worries.
Or scientists have egos, right? They want to get credit for things that they've done.
Right, but PR doesn't necessarily... mean you're going to get perfect credit. People can steal stuff.
Sure. But who in social circles around the world or 50 years later will recognize who invented the light bulb?
Right.
Right.
It's all about
Edison or Tesla.
Okay. Cool. All right. Let's wrap it up now. 48 minutes. We're good. I think the people have gotten what they want.
Have you gotten what you want? I don't know. Is that a song?
Probably.
Okay. If not, there you go. Science right. Police, first song. That's what it is.
Yeah. Tilde V.
Tilde V.
No, you're Tilde R.
I'm Tilde R.
All right. Till next time.
Till next time.